You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next hour, is Spain's fiesta over? Or, more realistically, is it even more over than we already suspected? The latest economic figures from Spain make more depressing reading than Lorca at his most mournful. We'll ask an economist if anything can be done and get the latest from our man in Madrid. Foreign visitors to Holland's coffee shops may shortly be disappointed to find their menu options restricted to coffee. New laws will forbid the sale of marijuana to foreigners. We have a trenchant reaction from a cafe owner and the bewildered burblings of some of his patrons. We'll also be joined by one half of the Financial Times problem-solving duo The Shrink and The Sage. The philosophical half of the pair, Julian Baghini, will be answering some of life's most, and indeed least, important questions. And we take another walk through the streets of Marylebone to meet a local business owner. This week, we're at the Third Space Gym on Bulstrode Place. All that, plus a chat with Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald and a song or two, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead of us. Thank you very much for joining me. But first, the news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. A suicide bomber has struck in the Syrian capital Damascus, killing 9 people and wounding 20 others outside a city mosque. The explosion ripped through worshippers at the Zain al-Abidain Mosque, which was under heavy security for Friday prayers. The United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has appealed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to stop the 13-month-long violence that has left thousands dead. Speaking at a press conference in New Delhi, Mr. Ban said that the plight of the Syrian people had crossed unacceptable boundaries and that the number of Syrian refugees trickling to neighbouring countries was a matter of great concern.
At least 1 million people have been affected by this situation. There are tens of thousands of refugees have fled the country to neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Turkey.
One of China's most prominent human rights advocates, the blind Chen Guangcheng, has escaped from house arrest in the east of the country. Mr. Chen, a self-taught legal advocate who campaigned against forced abortions, has been restricted to his home in Shandong province since September 2010 after he was released from jail. His confinement and relentless surveillance has fanned protests by Chinese sympathisers and criticism from foreign governments and activist groups. His current whereabouts are unclear. Officials from Pakistan, Afghanistan and the United States have said they'll explore ways to arrange safe passage for Afghan Taliban militants who wish to engage in peace talks. The representatives were meeting in the Pakistan capital Islamabad for 2 days as part of an initiative to revive stalled peace talks with the Taliban and to smooth relations between Washington and Islamabad. Spain's Foreign Minister José Manuel García Margallo says the country's faltering economy faces a crisis of huge proportions as unemployment hit its highest level in almost 2 decades and Standard & Poor's downgraded the government's debt by 2 notches. Unemployment shot up to 24% in the first quarter, one of the worst jobless figures in the developed world. Retail sales slumped for the 21st consecutive month as a recession cut into consumer spending. The country's economy minister has since announced he'll increase the country's value-added tax rate in 2013, as well as other indirect taxes, in order to raise about 8 billion euros. The UK Media and Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt has said he will hand over his private emails and phone texts to the Leveson inquiry into press ethics, following accusations of collusion with Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. The minister has been accused of helping News Corp in its attempt to secure a $12 billion takeover of the satellite broadcaster BSky B. Mr. Hunt spoke to reporters earlier.
I will be handing over all my private texts and emails to my special advisor, to the Leveson Inquiry, and I'm confident that they will vindicate the position that I handled the BSky B merger process with total integrity.
Emails suggesting Mr. Hunt had sought to help Mr. Murdoch in his business dealings were revealed during questioning of Mr. Murdoch's son James on Tuesday. Analysts say this goes to the heart of the accusations that Mr. Murdoch wields too much influence, creating a company culture that rides roughshod over rules. A letter written by the British bandleader on the Titanic to his parents in England 5 days before the ship struck an iceberg has sold for nearly $155,000 in an online auction. An unnamed US investment group bought the letter, written by 33-year-old Wallace Hartley. Mr. Hartley led the ship's 8-piece band. Other items in the sale included a letter written by a first-class passenger on Titanic stationery and a small salvaged piece of the ship's grand staircase. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 5 minutes past the hour here at Midori House in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'll be right back after this.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 is your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bropa Jalavert. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
It is a far from pleasant thought, but the recent economic catastrophes in Ireland and Greece may only have been warm-ups. Spain's unemployment rate has reached 24.4%, or more than 5.5 million people. Last night, Standard & Poor's downgraded Spain's sovereign debt 2 notches, from A to BBB+. Figures due for release on Monday are expected to surprise nobody by confirming that the tottering country has tipped back into recession. Spain's struggling banks and struggling government may be forced to seek a bailout of the kind that have recently sprung Ireland and Greece from debtors' prison, although the bill for Spain would be vastly bigger. Spain might well find that international institutions react to their approach by piling all the furniture against the doors and pretending to be on holiday. Joining me now is Dr. Richard Wellings. He's the Deputy Editorial Director of the Institute of Economic Affairs in London. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Andrew.
Why is unemployment so spectacularly bad in Spain in particular? It's bad in Ireland at 14.7% and it's dreadful in Greece at 21%, but it's worse in Spain. What's the reason for that?
Well, I think part of the reason is that Spain has very rigid labour market regulations, so it's very hard for the labour market to adapt to the new straitened circumstances. It's also to do with the size of the Spanish construction sector, which we saw grew to enormous proportions during the boom period. In fact, in 2007, I think more houses were built in Spain than in the United States, which shows the scale of it, and that's now collapsed, and that's led to enormous unemployment as well.
How bad could this get? I mean, if everything that could go wrong does go wrong, what could Spain look like, say, 3, 4, 5 years from now?
Well, basically, we're looking at something akin to the Great Depression in the United States. So we've already seen industrial production fall by about a quarter, very, very high unemployment rates, and youth unemployment now at 52%. So we could be looking at a prolonged slump like we saw in America in the 1930s.
Well, if we try to think positively and progressively, and supposing somebody was to put you in charge of Spain, and let's face it, they might soon run out of people who want the job, what would be the first few things you'd do?
Well, I think the new government in Spain is getting a couple of things right, but obviously progress is slow because of political opposition. But it is looking to liberalise the labour market and make it easier for firms to hire and fire, and that will help the adjustment process. It's also trying to reduce the budget deficit and instill confidence with the financial markets. That's not really working very well at the moment, but at least they're heading in the right direction. But the fundamental problem is they're part of the euro, and this one-size-fits-all monetary policy is going to create tensions the whole time because interest rates will tend to be set for Germany rather than for Spain and the other peripheral countries.
Well, this to me, in my admittedly inexpert view, I mean, I know even less about economics than most politicians, has always seemed to me to be the problem with the euro, that it involved countries giving up their right and ability to set their own monetary policy. At what point is the political will to keep the project going in the face of reality likely to crack, do you think?
Well, it could take quite a while. I mean, we've basically, over the last few months, we've seen the European Central Bank step in by basically lending all the banks in Europe billions, hundreds of billions of euros. And then the banks have then used that money to buy government debt, especially in the PIGS countries. But the problem is that creates this pyramid or a house of cards and makes the whole system more and more dependent and more vulnerable to a crash. So it could all end up very horribly.
But at some point or another, is it going to be necessary to let a country go, as it will? I mean, it was talked about with Greece, but you know, if a country, we've heard a lot of the phrase "too big to fail." Could Spain be too big to save?
Well, exactly, it is too big to save, particularly if Italy goes at the same time. But basically, if the other countries in the Eurozone had to bail out Spain, that would put their own public finances in jeopardy. I mean, some of the Northern European countries like Belgium are also in deep trouble as well, but Germany's liabilities would go through the roof if it had to bail out Spain. So I think it's completely out of the question.
So other than the things that are being done by the Spanish government, what's something they're not doing that they should be doing?
Well, they could go a lot faster on their current policies of trying to cut the deficits and also to liberalise the labour market. But I think, I mean, a lot of the problem rests with the EU in Brussels, and Brussels needs to take the lead and actually start deregulating from the centre, because we have things like very ambitious climate change targets, numerous new labour market regulations in the pipeline from Brussels, and that's really the last thing these countries need.
Yeah, it's not a terribly hopeful outlook if we're all kind of staking our hopes on a deregulatory impulse emanating from Brussels all of a sudden. How much resistance is there in Spain at the moment among the Spanish public to these kind of measures? Because as we're seeing in France, the trouble with austerity measures is, though they may be necessary, they're not terrifically popular.
That's right. Well, basically, when we had the massive inflation, this big boom in Spain, the government also increased government spending enormously, and that's created a huge number of vested interest groups that are reliant on government spending. So that makes it much, much harder to cut. And they're going to, you know, there are going to be huge demonstrations, huge protests, and that's entirely to be expected.
Richard, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House this evening. We're going to cross now to Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Algis. Liam, good evening. How are you?
I'm great, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. But what about the country you're in? What's the general mood like there?
Well, it's not too good. And I've got the interesting position of having lived here in 2005 and 2006 when there was the boom, when times were great. And I moved back a year ago, and the contrast is actually quite strong. The mood is quite negative. People are still, and the Spanish are renowned for being fun-loving and quite happy people, always up for a fiesta. But now everyone is still up for the fiestas, but everyone is quite negative. The rhetoric, the daily conversations are always talking about the news, and Spanish are more self-deprecating than ever. They're quite renowned for they're quite critical of their own country, but in kind of a joking way. But now things are getting quite serious, and every day I'm talking to people who are worried about losing their job, who are worried about being on unemployment benefits for an indefinite period of time, and yeah, it dominates the national, the daily discourse, if you will.
Are you meeting many people who are talking about leaving? I mean, in the year up to September 2011, 50,000 Spaniards and some change left the country, which was up 36% on the year before. Is there concern about a brain drain, which is, it's always one of the things that make an economic crisis worse, that the people with the transferable skills and with the money are in the best position to push off and try their luck somewhere else?
There is definitely a very common thread in people I talk to, particularly young people who all want to come to London. Maybe you'll see a few at Midori House soon. But everyone is talking about leaving. If they don't have plans to leave, immediate plans, then they're talking about making them, because things don't look like they're getting any better. So if you don't have a plan to leave to get work, then you're going to be stuck here and on unemployment benefits, which is actually an interesting thing, because the unemployment benefit system here is quite interesting, that you actually earn unemployment benefit time. So if you work for a certain period of time, you get 2 years. Say if you work for 5 years or 3 years, you get 2 years of unemployment benefits. So I think there's a problem actually entrenched in the system.
Yeah, really hard to imagine how that setup's open to abuse.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of people I talk to, it's a thing that is quite eye-opening, is that people say, oh, well, if they fire me, what I'm going to do? I've got 1 year of unemployment benefits. I'm going to go on holiday or go to London and try and work, and then I'll come back 2 months before and then start looking for work. So I think this needs to be changed as well. It really needs to be looked at.
Are you encountering any flickers of optimism at all? I ask because I did a story for Monocle about a year and a half ago in Ireland, just as the wheels fell off there, and I was very surprised to discover a lot of people in Dublin actually quite positive, looking at it as an opportunity for sort of rebirth and rethinking.
There definitely are some people. I don't think it's not as big. The movement of these positive people isn't as big as it should be, or as I would personally like it to be. But there are people taking advantage of turning their lemons into lemonade, if you will. I mean, there are people who are changing their approach to business, who are trying to sell overseas. People are embracing the internet to sell their items. I met one lady who has a swimwear business, and she's just spent all this money, even though she's got a lot less income. She spent all this money on going to international trade fairs to break into the Asian market, to break into the rest of the European market, because Spanish people aren't buying. So if people don't wake up and start engaging with foreign markets, they're going to lose out.
Speaking to our previous guest there, Richard Wellings from the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, about the problem that governments in Spain's position have, which is that essentially they're broke and therefore need to make cutbacks. But if they try to do that, as I think we're about to see in France this weekend, they tend to lose office. The Spaniards you're talking to, not the politicians, but just people in day-to-day life, do they recognise that there is a need for cutbacks and there is a need for austerity, or would they prefer the government to carry on spending money it doesn't actually have?
I think there's been quite a big quantity of announcements of cutbacks and changes to laws all at the start of the new government's term. So people are still kind of in shock and still adjusting to all these changes. But at the end of the day, people do recognise that it's necessary, because if you watch the news, you know things are not going to get any better. So if people don't change, or the government doesn't change, then it will only get worse. So people do recognize, but then there is quite a lot of demonstrations every week in Madrid. There seems to be, the main streets seem to be cut off, and there's big demonstrations by one or more vested interest groups. So, I mean, it's going to get worse, so we'll probably see more demonstrations. And as I talked about a few days ago, the recent sabotage of the Madrid Metro against the price hikes in the Madrid Metro is I think, marks a new phase in the demonstration movement. They're taking their protest to the next level, so it's interesting.
Liam, thank you as ever for joining us. That's Liam Algis, Monocle's man in Madrid. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll hear some music from American Music Club after this.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops, from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand. Some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. And by way of cueing our imminent report from the Netherlands, this is American Music Club with Hello Amsterdam.
Hello!
That was Hello Amsterdam by American Music Club, and we'll be saying Hello Amsterdam right after this. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Beginning next week, Holland's infamous coffee shops might start having to repurpose themselves as, well, coffee shops. A new law which bans foreigners from buying soft drugs in the Netherlands comes into force in the southern provinces on May the 1st and in the rest of the country on January the 1st. This is obviously good news for Dutch people who've grown weary of fishing stone students in stupid hats out of their canals, but it will represent a major dent in the income of the Netherlands' 700 cannabis cafes. One proprietor in Maastricht, where the ban originated, suggests that 4,000 jobs might be lost. By some estimations, a third of visitors to Amsterdam, whose mayor is against this ban, unsurprisingly, are enticed in part by the opportunity to inhale aromatic fug unharried by the police. Joining me now is John Tyler, the political editor of Radio Netherlands Worldwide. Good evening, John.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. John, where has this ban come from? Because for decades, Holland has traded on this reputation as a bastion of liberalism where soft drugs are concerned. Why the clampdown?
Well, there's been a trend that basically started at least 10 years ago here in the Netherlands to stop tolerating all the things that used to be tolerated, and cannabis is there amongst them. There was a ban on selling magic mushrooms that came into place a couple of years ago, so you can't get that anymore in the Netherlands. Of course, the smoking ban is quite infamous. That's been imposed in lots of other countries as well, but that was controversial when it was imposed here and remains so. There are other things, you know, the prostitution in Amsterdam is famous for its prostitution, and that's also being cracked down on. The mayor has been trying for a couple of years ago to basically going after the criminality involved in prostitution, but is limiting that trade here as well. And now it's with cannabis. And I have to say this is a kind of a typically Dutch situation, both the way people can get cannabis itself and this new law. Cannabis has never been legalized in the Netherlands. That's the funny misconception everyone has. It's always just been tolerated that people can buy, always have to say, since the 70s, that people are allowed to buy a small amount for private consumption. But while consumption for private use is tolerated, the supply of the cannabis itself is not. That remains illegal. So they call that the back door. So people who are supplying these coffee shops for their drugs have to do it very secretly, obviously, out of the way of authorities, and it remains a criminal offence.
But surely, as you say, there's always been this bizarre fudged compromise on the subject, which sort of seems to suggest that the situation might continue whether there's a law or not. But especially given that the government which introduced this law just collapsed, is there actually any chance that this law is ever going to be enforced by anybody?
Well, that's a very good question, because now, of course, since Saturday, everything seems to be up in the air here in the Netherlands. The thing is, though, the weed pass had actually started before this government happened. It was in the parliament before the last elections already, and the law has been passed and now is supposed to be imposed. So I don't think the fall of this government is going to change the imposition of this law in particular. What is, you know, does have more an effect at the moment, you have these court cases. Now, the coffee shop owners and some mayors who also signed on with them objecting to the law, who had brought this court case that was decided today, they lost today, but they've said that they are going to appeal. This law has already been up and down the court systems a couple of times. It went through the Dutch court to the highest court in Holland, and then it went to the European court. The European court decided in favor of the government, saying you can discriminate against foreigners. That's what it's about. It's an anti-discrimination clause in Dutch law and in European law. And the European court said you can discriminate against foreigners on the basis of public order, as long as it's, you know, needed for public order. Then it comes back to the Netherlands, and the mayors and the coffee shop owners say, hey, you know, there's no public order problem. We don't have to discriminate. We have no public order problem. So in the absence of that argument, you have to let us do it. The court in The Hague today said, no, that's not relevant. You have to talk about a broader public order, the whole country. They may appeal it to further in the Netherlands. They may go to the Court of Human Rights in Europe. So the court aspect of it is not done. Just as important is that a lot of mayors even, not to talk about coffee shop owners, say they're going to disobey the law, that they're not going to impose it. Maastricht, they're supposed to start May 1st, only selling to people who belong to the club. That's what it's about. You in order to get cannabis from May 1st in the southern provinces, you have to be a resident of the Netherlands, you have to prove it, join a club, which is the coffee shop, show your pass, and you can get the drug. Well, Maastricht, they're not passing out the passes. They say, we're not going to do it.
John, thanks very much for joining us this evening. Earlier today, Monocle contributor Cynthia Taylor spoke with one coffee shop owner, Claire Koch, from the New Moon coffee shop in Amsterdam.
We just have to look if we survive, because if the wheat press is coming, we don't know if we can survive with only the clients we have from only the Netherlands. Because a lot of Dutch people, they smoke, but also a lot of tourists, they come. And if the tourists cannot buy anymore in our coffee shop, they try to buy it on the street. So also on the street, it will be devastating for the Netherlands.
You mean that there will be more illegal selling in the, on the streets?
A lot more little dealers are going to be on the street to supply all the tourists. Because if you come to Amsterdam and you want to smoke one joint, you have to, for example, you just have to look on the streets then. Because you cannot buy anymore at my place. I think it's a shame for the coffee shops that we have to work like that, you know. Because it's already legal for like 30, 40 years. So what's the deal now after so long time?
How much of your clientele are actually foreigners?
Well, like 90%, so it's a lot.
So if, as from next year, let's say a British citizen comes to Amsterdam and wants to buy a joint, what will he or she do?
I think they will go to the streets, because if they're going to try with me, I have to say no. You know, I also have to explain for them that it's a stupid rule of the Netherlands, but I cannot help them, because it can make a lot of problem for me. We have to shut down only because we have to, because we want to sell one joint, yeah. It's just stupid. It's really, really stupid. Because everybody has the right to smoke. Even if it's foreigners coming to the Netherlands, come on, for what you come to Amsterdam for? For the smoking, for the red light, for everything that is nice from Amsterdam. You don't want to be here and you see everybody smoking, but you cannot smoke it yourself.
Why do you think the government is forcing this law through?
Well, it's been legal for so many years, but the back door, like the growing, it's not, it's illegal. So I think that they think like, okay, the growing is illegal, we also make the coffee shop a little bit illegal. In the borders of the Netherlands, you have Belgium, you have Germany, you have Luxembourg. If people come from there every weekend to Amsterdam, it's a lot of traffic, it's a lot of tourists only buy, and a lot of coffee shop, their supply is more than only 500 grams that they can have every day. So it's not fair against other coffee shop that they sell too much. A lot of tourists, they come here, you know, they're just enjoying, they're not making lots of trouble. Only the people who are drinking alcohol together, mixed with the joints, they make trouble. But only for the few people, because I think like this, it's good. You know, everybody comes to Amsterdam, has his own thing, you go to smoke or you go to the museum. It's whatever you like to do, you know. So do it like this, it's not going to work. I know for sure it's not going to work.
What will happen?
A lot of illegally on the streets. That is what's going to happen. And if we have to say as a coffee shop, like no to the tourists, maybe we also have to close if we cannot survive from only the people, from the Dutch people. But we will wait and we will see. It's the only thing what you can do.
We also heard of some opinions, at least we're pretty sure that's what we heard from a few of the shop's customers.
My name is Liviu. Actually, I don't know too many things about this law, but from my opinion, I think it will be bad for tourism and the people they come to enjoy some weed in the legal place, like it's Amsterdam. So, I don't know. Amsterdam will feel a little bit economic, I think. And also the people, they will miss this for sure. And also they will make the illegal weed to sell more.
And if you come back to Amsterdam next year, for instance, and you cannot go to a coffee shop, how will you get hold of your weed then?
For sure, there will be somebody on the street and they will sell it. I'll still smoke whatever is happening.
My name is John. I find it a good idea. Still, I think that the better way is to inform the people from outside or from overseas, to inform the people how to use the drugs. And any kind of way, if you're using any kind of from weed until to hashish, to pot, to everything. And as long as they give enough information and good information, then it's maybe able to be used by more than only the Dutch people. It doesn't say that the Dutch people know how to use it, but we're more familiar with it.
So you believe that there is an issue with foreigners coming to coffee shops?
No, it's not an issue, only they don't know what they're taking and they don't know how to use it. And if you only use weed, then don't use alcohol at the same time. We have more problems with people who are drinking themselves into coma. instead of people who are smoking themselves towards Bob Marley.
I'm Jerry, I'm 70 years old. No, I think it's stupid. It's not really necessary, you know, because I think they're gonna come less tourists here because of the weed pass.
You think it's gonna be bad for the economy?
Yeah.
My name is Max. It's a very unnecessary precaution because if tourists can't buy weed on their own, they'll just ask someone to buy it for them. On top of that, they wanna throw in the weed pass because of underage people that buy the weed. Well, they're gonna find as many people as they want to buy the weed for them, so it's not gonna change anything.
Will you be selling also on the street?
Yeah, to tourists, but not to underage people.
Incredible that no one's given Jerry and Max their own show. In the next half hour on Midori House, Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald joins us to talk about what's in his section of the current print edition of Monocle. We'll talk with half of the brains behind the Financial Times' Shrink and the Sage column, and we'll continue our campaign of introducing ourselves to all of Monocle's many and occasionally very surprised neighbours. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
A suicide bomber has struck in the Syrian capital Damascus, killing 9 people and wounding 20 others outside a city mosque. The explosion ripped through worshippers at the Zain al-Abidin Mosque, which was under heavy security for Friday prayers. State media said security officials were among the wounded. One of China's most prominent human rights advocates, the blind Chen Guangcheng, has escaped from house arrest in the east of the country. Mr. Chen, a self-taught legal advocate who campaigned against forced abortions, has been restricted to his home in Shandong province since September 2010 after he was released from jail. His confinement and relentless surveillance has fanned protests by Chinese sympathizers and criticism from foreign governments and activist groups. His current whereabouts are unclear. Officials from Pakistan, Afghanistan and the United States have said they'll explore ways to arrange safe passage for Afghan Taliban militants who wish to engage in peace talks. The representatives were meeting in the Pakistan capital Islamabad for 2 days as part of an initiative to revive stalled peace talks with the Taliban and to smooth relations between Washington and Islamabad. Spain's Foreign Minister José Manuel García Margallo says the country's faltering economy faces a crisis of huge proportions as unemployment hit its highest level in almost 2 decades and Standard & Poor's downgraded the government's debt by 2 notches. Unemployment shot up to 24% in the first quarter, one of the worst jobless figures in the developed world. And a letter written by the British bandleader on the Titanic to his parents in England 5 days before the ship struck an iceberg has sold for nearly $155,000 in an online auction. An unnamed US investment group bought the letter, written by 33-year-old Wallace Hartley. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. Now, the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which I'm holding in my hands right now, is on newsstands around the world and all this week on Midori House. We're chatting to the editors and writers who made it happen. And today, the man in the hot seat is Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, about what to look out for in his section this month. Hugo, we have a centrefold in your section.
We
this
do.
Month.
You've gone straight to the centrefold.
As is in my invariable habit.
It's not the centrefold that people might be expecting, though.
Actually, from Monocle, it's pretty much exactly the centrefold they might be expecting.
It is. It's the dream house.
It's our dream house.
It's a blueprint of the perfect house. It happens in the middle of our 32-page design directory, which is always the special thing to look out for in every May issue of Monocle. And in it, we've compiled a series of things that we would put together to make up the perfect house. It's everything from the things to fill it with to the basic layout that one should be following for really the best sort of living experience possible.
So first of all, where are we building it?
Well, we've decided to build it on the shores of Lake Zug in Switzerland, because that not only has easy access to Zurich, so you can feasibly use it for sort of getaway weekends every now and then, but also it's spectacular natural scenery there, and it hasn't been sort of developed as much as some of the shoreside settings in the rest of Switzerland or throughout Europe or North America.
And what distinguishes the house's decor? Why is it different from any other chalet that you would find huddled around Lake Zug?
Well, it's less about Decor, although we do have an inventory of the top 25 companies and services to call on, which are everything from sort of the local Swiss carpenters that we've used to kit out Midori House to the people who can provide you with your best cackle offen, which is a tiled ceramic oven, a very efficient way of heating your home. But it's actually more about the sort of lifestyle that laying out your house in the way that we prescribe encourages. It's about one huge open plan living space downstairs with sort of loose zones separated. And then upstairs, much sort of cozier environments for having guests to stay. Bathrooms conveniently located so you don't have to hear your house guests doing their business in the morning. And then a little nook at the top of the house to escape to for sort of more indulgent things.
I was just looking at that. It possibly says terrible things about me that the character in the house I rather identified with was the terribly pleased chap sitting up by himself in the attic, two floors above the hubbub happening downstairs.
No, there's a bit of that in all of us. I think he's just finished his world record-selling novel.
He does have the very smug demeanour of somebody who's just finished something. He's also got a ladder leading to the escape hatch, should he really need it.
If you really need to escape further up, then that's where you go.
Are we actually going to build this house? I think we totally should.
We could do. It's got other highlights, like a little mobile sauna down by the lakeside that can be used. Yeah, so on the back of the actual blueprint, then we have little details about how it should be lived in. And there's a little mobile sauna on wheels, which is made by a fantastic small architecture firm called Denizen Works. And it fits about four people in it snugly.
Okay, and what are some other highlights from our design directory? Because this is the fifth design directory we've done.
This is the fifth one, exactly. And, well, there's a sort of theme running throughout the whole thing, which is putting power back into the hands of the designer. We've sort of celebrated local producing, local designing, local retailing, as a way of showing that in today's design world, the traditional sort of manufacturer, designer, retailer model, which is what the design industry has really relied upon for the last sort of 50 or 60 years, isn't working quite so well. But it's very possible to be a designer and to make a very handsome living from designing and making yourself and engaging with a retailer who only really sells local designers. And this is sort of something that consumers are more and more aware of and buying into more and more too.
You've also been at Salon de Mobile recently.
Salone del Mobile.
No, I was near enough. close enough for rock and roll.
You obviously weren't listening to our live shows, Andrew. You would have heard me say that many times every morning.
I was, assiduously.
I have been.
And what did we learn there this year?
Well, it's a similar kind of theme, which is, as I said, because of this designer-manufacturer relationship not working quite so well. Manufacturers don't have money to invest in creating nearly as many new products. And so designers have, over the last few years, been showing prototypes that the manufacturers haven't been picking up on to put into production. So designers have taken things back into their own hands and are now not just designing the products, but also the machines to manufacture them themselves.
And they're starting to look at new ways of funding as well, using things
funding,
like
exactly,
Kickstarter.
Crowdfunding. Kickstarter had an exhibition, or was part of a bigger exhibition looking at the future of making and selling that took place in Milan during the week. And the things that Kickstarter has successfully funded that have gone on to become sort of global success stories are incredible. And it's everything from sort of technology to sort of craft products, but also sort of proper industrial designed products as well. It's sort of proof that actually design and designers don't really have to despair as much as we thought they did last year.
Well, that's a happy message, I think, to take away from our new issue. You don't need to despair as much as you might have thought you did.
It's never as bad as it seems.
Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House today. It's 6:40 in the evening here in London. We'll be right back with a song after this.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
The Ben Folds 5 with philosophy, and we'll be talking to an actual philosopher right after this.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This she makes me wanna dance. Is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors-turned-DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It is without doubt the world's highest falutin agony column. Each week in the Financial Times Weekend magazine, psychotherapist Antonia Macaro and philosopher Julian Baghini, the shrink and the sage as they bill themselves, consider various everyday dilemmas from their divergent professional perspectives. Adding to the tension is the fact that they live together and must therefore be assumed to be practicing what they're preaching. They've now summed up what they've learnt in a book called The Shrink and the Sage, A Guide to Living. We're joined now by the sage half of the partnership, Julian Baghini. Welcome, Julian.
Good afternoon.
First of all, and I want to put to you a couple of dilemmas to resolve with a psychological approach shortly, but are the psychoanalytic and philosophical approaches essentially contradictory or complementary?
Well, they might be, but actually it's interesting you use the term psychoanalytic there, because that's not really the approach. I mean, when people think about psychotherapy, they often think about psychoanalysis, but that's actually one very particular form of psychotherapy. In fact, that a lot of practitioners don't follow that kind of Freudian approach, and Antonia certainly doesn't. But it's not our view that they're not contradictory. You see them very much as complementary, or at their best they can be. I think what's often missing from psychotherapy is a really rigorous examination of values. It tends to assume that we know what we want, which is for people to feel better and so forth. And what's missing from philosophy often is a sense of how it might have practical application. But I think they can be brought together in fruitful ways, and it's basically using philosophical tools to help you reflect upon not just, you know, how to achieve your goals, if you like, but what perhaps those goals should be and what a good life is really like.
Well, the philosophical tools are, of course, your department in the partnership, and I wanted to invite you to apply those to a couple of philosophical questions. And first of all, the big one, I guess, which is happiness. And most suggestions I read about how a person can be happy sound to me, frankly, like really incredibly hard work. I'm really quite constitutionally lazy, so what I'm wondering about is, what's the easiest way to be happy?
Well, the easiest way to be happy is probably to give up trying. In the sense that when it comes to, I mean, it's one of the things that philosophy helps with here is, of course, the question is, what do we mean here by happiness? And, you know, that's not nitpicky. It's actually really fundamental. And a lot of the work in recent years in positive psychology, and the early work in particular, did rather kind of focus on positive mood, good mood, really, which is, we all kind of know, is a bit superficial. But on the other hand, you can't seem to totally divorce that from happiness. So, I mean, really, if you think about, you know, forget about your mood, which you can't often control a lot anyway. Martin Seligman, for example, is one of the leading proponents of positive psychology. He's known as a happiness guru. But by temperament, he's quite miserable. He says this himself. And he finds that quite resistant. So in terms of, like, you know, finding satisfaction, fulfillment, and things like that, I think the way to do that is not to worry too much about changing your mood. Your mood is something that will take care of itself depending on how you're feeling. You should really think about what's worthwhile to you, what really matters to you instead.
Is that just a question then of kind of recalibrating bad moods as, so you think of them as not necessarily a bad thing?
Well, that's an interesting point. And again, there's lots in certain strands of psychotherapy, recent strands of psychotherapy, which of course I learn about all through Antonia rather than through myself, is that there is this kind of emphasis on that actually a lot of the time, rather than focusing on trying to change things, including our moods, we can actually go a long way by simply changing how we relate to them. So mood, for example, I mean, I sometimes do this myself. I find myself in bad moods for really stupid reasons. You know, and basically, if I'm tired or hungry, I'm going to be in a bad mood. You know, these aren't big existential issues. And sometimes these things are really hard to shift, though. You can't just snap yourself out of it by thinking, I'm only feeling this because I'm tired. But what you can say is, okay, it's just a mood. You know, it's just a mood. I can't necessarily change it
but it's no big deal. It's a bad mood. I'll let it pass when it's. I won't make too much of it, and that's often more helpful than thinking, oh, I really must get out of this mood. What can I do? You know, that can just give yourself two problems for the price of one, which I think is a catchphrase of a psychotherapist called Windy Dryden.
Well, another counterintuitive proposition I'd like to put to you then. When I'm not sitting in this studio talking to people such as yourself, I'm a self-employed writer, which obviously means you're prone to no end of, you know, distraction activities and procrastination. So I'm basically asking you to reinforce my own poor behaviour here and tell me a reason why procrastination might actually be a good thing.
Well, of course, often it isn't, I'm afraid, but sometimes it is. I think that the why is procrastination considered a bad thing? Well, if you think about it, historically, it probably has been, because we couldn't do too many things in a terrible hurry. If there's something that sort of could be done, it normally should be done. The problem now is that we're so well connected, things are so instant, we have every opportunity to do everything instantly. And a lot of those things we perhaps shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't just say impulse buy. We have so many impulse buying opportunities now. Just sitting in front of a computer, you can impulse buy. You can make decisions and get them implemented straight away. So I think these days we have so many opportunities to do things quickly and then repent at leisure that actually it would be helpful to try and procrastinate. You know, there's that old saying, which is never put off until tomorrow what you could do today. I think that in our sort of overly hurried times, we should invert that, and rather we should say, you know, never do today what you could put off till tomorrow without cost. That without cost thing is important. Of course, sometimes if you put something off, you lose the opportunity. But 9 times out of 10, I think, if we think about it, there is no need to rush to a decision now. Put it off until tomorrow. Sleep on it.
I think that's excellent advice, which I'm going to put to my publisher tomorrow and tell them you told me to say it. And finally, I guess there was a practical one I wanted to put to you to see if philosophy is applicable in everyday life, in that we're, in theory at least, approaching the part of the year in Britain in which the weather's going to improve. And one thing I have noticed in my 22 years living in this country is that British are incapable of enjoying sunshine quietly. So people's neighbours are going to get noisy, which is an incredibly vexatious and depressing thing to have to live with. Is there a philosophical approach that can either solve this problem or at least make it bearable?
Well, I don't think it's the one who's solved it. It might make it a bit more bearable. I have this problem as well. We live next door to students, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
So it's an all-year-round problem. But if they are listening, you're not as bad as some, but nevertheless could do better. You know, B minus. Yes. No, I think this is one of those ones whereby the real value that philosophy can have, and it's a very broad-brush philosophy, though, is simply a reminder of imperfection of things. I mean, you know, life is imperfect, people are imperfect, we're flawed. And in a sense, you know, if you're sitting in your garden, perhaps you've got a lovely garden and it would be a lovely day but for this noise, I think, you know, you can take it as an opportunity to remind yourself that, you know, in fact, perfection is unattainable and you can't control certain things. That's the thing about it, you can't control them. And you have to learn to live with things that you can't control and imperfection and just accept what is nonetheless still very good about it. And, you know, if we manage to be lucky enough to have some days which are warm enough to sit out in the garden and enjoy it, then rather than focus on the things which are stopping that being sort of 100% wonderful, I think you should probably try to focus on the things that make it nonetheless better than the alternatives, which is staying inside and looking out into the horrible rain, as I think we're doing all over the country now.
Is there a particular philosophical text that you think people should consult when they're tempted to go next door with a crowbar up one sleeve?
Well, I don't know about it. I think the general text people should consult is Aristotle's Ethics. I mean, that is the real point of overlap between myself and Antonia in terms of our influences. Aristotle is a deeply sort of wise and pragmatic person who is philosophical and rigorous, but also does accept the fact that in matters of everyday living and real life, you can't be too precise and excessively logical. You have to sort of deal with things as they are. And Aristotle will always kind of stress the extent to which the right approach to everything is almost certainly not either extreme. You know, we tend to often see things in terms of either ors. And rather than encouraging us to think about polarities, he encourages us to think about where the kind of appropriate point between those two polarities are. So I think that overall, Aristotle is your fundamental philosophical guide to life, and everything else is basically footnotes to that.
Julian Baghini, otherwise known as the Sage of the Financial Times, the Shrink and the Sage column, thank you very much for joining us. This is Midori House.
LDNTYO. NYC MTF.
Thank you, Kylie. Every week on Midori House, we meet our local neighbours in Marylebone in London. This week, we head to the Third Space Gym in Bulstrode Place. From boxing classes to Pilates, they have everything you need to keep fit. Besides working out there, you can always visit their luxurious spa. Our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to visit and spoke with Dan Lloyd-James, general manager of the Third Space, who tells us a bit more about his premium gym.
My name's Dan. I'm the general manager of Third Space in Marylebone. It's the second Third Space that's opened in London. Our other club is based in Soho and has been open for 10 years now. It's a very different space to your normal health club. We like to think that we're very relaxed, but we're very focused on our members and we want them all to achieve the results that they come in for. So we have a number of different members who hope to achieve different things, be it an Ironman or a triathlon in extreme cases, to those who just want to be able to maybe get upstairs without getting out of breath or have some health concerns. So we have utilised our spaces by having lots of natural light, lots of great equipment in the space, and organised some of the best trainers in London to give guidance to our members. We have got a fully equipped gym here in Marylebone with an 80-metre swimming pool, steam room, saunas and spa, so we offer a space to train, relax and enjoy, but we also want to make training exciting. We want to make it functional, we want to make it interesting and creative. So here we have a retro gym and we look at functional training and bodyweight training, and down in Soho we have a climbing wall and we have a hypoxic chamber for training at altitude. So hopefully it's an exciting space for people to come and do something different each time they enter the facility. We roughly run about 90 classes a week at Marylebone, and at Soho it's about 130. The popularity of classes sort of goes up and down seasonally, so we've got Fighting Fit, which is in our studio downstairs, which is very, very popular at the moment with Greg, who's a professional boxing coach. But we've got Park Fitness and Running Club, so coming now into the end of April, hopefully the rain will stop. Those two classes will become really, really popular. I think a lot of people enjoy the guidance and training, and if we can take that outside as well, enjoy a little bit of London outside and a little bit of the parks, then that's an added bonus for our members. It's a real mixed group. We've got a lot of different people who come through, so all, you know, we cater for all age groups and guys and gals, loads of different things. What I think they've all got in common is that they all want to achieve health and fitness goals, and they're quite serious about doing that, and they've made a commitment to us for a year, and we'll guide and support them through that. So yeah, like I said, whether they're competing in an Ironman, where they've got some very serious high-level goals, or something just more about their health and well-being on a daily basis, we can support and help them. So I think that's one of the things that makes the club a fantastic space, is you will see all kinds of different people in here, but they're all heads up, really happy, really enjoying the vibe that we have on our gym floor. So it's a really great experience. It was a new venture for us when we opened in Marylebone a year ago to create a spa. We wanted to, every time we open a new site, we want to create something new. And we thought that having a spa and offering that kind of luxury package alongside the health and fitness and well-being was an important part of it. We have a brand partnership with Pio, which is a French company. And we're really, really pleased with the products that they supply us with and the treatment ranges that we can offer. So I think health and fitness and well-being is about, yeah, training very hard in the gym, burning those calories or lifting those weights, but it's also making sure that you're rested and you're supple and you're energized to go again. So massage treatments, facials, they can all really improve someone's self-confidence and therefore their self-worth, so it can make a real lifestyle change. I really, really love Marylebone. I think it's got a great village feel, the area. We are only, 3 or 4 minutes walk from the bustle of Oxford Street and Oxford Circus, but you feel like you're in a village, you feel like you're away from the centre of London. And the great thing for a sort of keen sort of runner, which I am, is you've got Hyde Park in one corner to the sort of southwest, and then you've got Regent's Park to the north-northwest. And so, you know, very quickly, even though you are in the centre of London, you can get out and you can get into the park to do a great run or a great workout. And there is a real community feel to it. The fair is a fantastic event that goes on each year, and then the turning on of the Christmas lights is always great, and it's always really, really encouraging to work in an area where you get to see the same faces all the time and the same members coming through. It's just a really positive, community-spirited place.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and that's all for this edition of Midori House. Thank you very much for listening. News is next.